DW Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
From DW Studios in Bonn, this is Living Planet, and I'm Charlotte Lomas. We start the show in Johannesburg, South Africa, where this week representatives from 182 countries are meeting to discuss the urgent problem of illegal wildlife trade. A key topic at the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, otherwise known as CITES, is how to increase protection of African elephants and rhinoceroses. Despite an international ban on the trade of ivory and horn in place since 1989, elephants and rhinos continue to be slaughtered at alarming rates, falling victim to poachers.
We're not winning this battle.
Tom Milliken from TRAFFIC, a wildlife trade monitoring network, says the demand for ivory and horn comes mostly from Asia, and in particular, China.
Overall, China and the massive expansion of the middle class in that country is really responsible for driving the bulk of the trade.
In parts of Asia, such as China, Vietnam and Thailand, rhino horn is believed to have medical and aphrodisiac properties. This precious horn is used in pharmaceuticals, food and jewellery. It also has value as a status symbol, fetching up to $100,000 a kilo.
We have seen that the price of illegal ivory on the black market in places like China and Hong Kong has increased by double-digit figures every year since 1993 until 2015.
And such high prices are fueling poaching by wildlife trafficking rings in Africa.
Asian criminal syndicates are now running the trade out of Africa, and the biggest barrier is that Africa does not have the capacity, the law enforcement capacity, to address foreign crime syndicates that are operative here.
It's estimated that illegal wildlife trade is worth about $20 billion a year. It's the world's fourth largest illegal trade after narcotics, counterfeiting, and human trafficking. But tackling a problem of this scale is no easy feat. Pelham Jones, the chairman of South Africa's Private Rhino Owners Association, says current measures just aren't working.
What we have seen under this CITES ban is 23 African countries losing all of their rhino, approximately 100,000 rhino being poached. We are seeing of the remaining 10 countries with rhino, five of them with populations of around 100 animals. Uganda has 13 rhino left. So you can clearly see by any parameter, the ban has not worked. So we have to look at alternatives.
Jones believes that enabling a legal supply of farmed horn is the only way to end poaching. This includes carefully harvesting, in other words, sawing off, the horn from the rhinos without killing them. The horn is then sold on the market.
Legal trade should be allowed. In other words, sell currently worthless stockpile, turn it into revenue that can be brought back to rhino conservation.
It's a highly controversial topic and one that sparked a heated debate at the CITES conference this week. The Kingdom of Swaziland put forward a proposal that would allow it to sell rhino horn internationally. But that measure was met with fierce opposition from delegates, explains CITES Secretary General John Scanlon.
Highly controversial, hasn't generated a huge amount of support from what we can gather. We made a recommendation on this proposal. We've recommended that it be rejected. We have applied the precautionary approach. We've raised a number of questions. There is no legal rhino horn trade now. As I said, to open it up, you'd really have to be very sure of what the consequences were. We say we're not. We say apply the precautionary approach. It ought to be rejected.
Sabri Zain, Director of Policy at TRAFFIC, agrees the risk of legalising the rhino horn trade is simply too high.
Globally, the levels of poaching and trade in rhino horn right now are so high. Populations of rhinos are dwindling to levels that are so worrying. Any chance of a legalised trade leading to a spurt in demand or leading to illegal rhino horn being laundered as legal rhino horn, just a small chance of that is going to have a huge impact on rhino populations, and we think it's not worth the risk.
A As delegates in Johannesburg discuss the different approaches to combating illegal wildlife trade, not too far away, a war is waging on some of the world's most endangered species. National parks in Africa are working tirelessly to protect these animals from highly organised and well-armed poachers. But it's dangerous work. An estimated 1,000 park rangers have been killed in the line of duty over the past decade. So how do you catch a poacher? Well, in Virunga National Park in the Democratic Republic of Congo, authorities have set up a special dog unit to track and capture poachers. Our reporter Maeve Francis went to find out more.
It's early morning at the headquarters of Virunga National Park, and the hounds are restless. As Africa's oldest national park, Virunga is famous for its high level of biodiversity and rare native animals. But it's also home to some pretty hard-working domestic animals with a very special job.
They have done a lot of mission to track the ribbons who killed the elephants.
That's David Twirangire Nezehose, a ranger with Virunga's special canine unit. These rangers and dogs are tasked with tracking poachers that threaten the park's endangered animals. Set up in 2011, the unit has spent years learning from international hound tracking experts. David introduces me to his hound, Sabrina.
Sabrina, hey! So this one, she found the two elephants killed in a ruined sector. Is this one, this dog. She has three years. She was born in USA. Yeah, she's American. Yes, we'll see what she's able to do in the park.
David is taking Sabrina out for her daily training. The hounds often work with bullet casings. Discarded cartridges are the easiest way to get the scent of a poacher. Today, fellow ranger Fidel is acting as the poacher. He's left us with a bullet casing imbued with his scent, and we're going to track him.
And we're using Sabrina.
Yeah, my favorite dog. I put this.
David puts the bullet casing in a Ziploc bag and briefly places it over Sabrina's nose so she can learn the scent.
And we begin immediately. Shash.
Sabrina darts off into the forest, her nose to the ground. The rangers jog behind her, single file. David is one of 380 park rangers who patrol the 790,000 hectares of jungle, savanna, rainforest, even alpine forests and glaciers. It's not easy. If you divided up the entire park among all of its rangers, they'd each have to patrol an area of around 2,000 hectares. Decades of instability have forced more than 2.6 million people from their homes and seen the rise of powerful rebel groups. Exploitation of the country's mineral wealth, coupled with weak governance and widespread poverty, make it a ripe region for poachers. It's a lucrative business. Elephants are most commonly targeted for their valuable ivory tusks. Primates, including the mountain gorilla, are hunted for bushmeat and the exotic animal trade. Other animals are simply casualties caught in a poacher's snare. Khairul Saleh is the species coordinator for the World Wildlife Fund in Indonesia. He says that endangered animals all over the world are facing similar problems as populations grow, habitats shrink, and resources become limited. To combat the problem, Saleh says a joint effort is needed.
Yeah, I think we can do it two levels. Yeah, on the site level, and of course we need to strengthen the patrols, yeah, the patrols in collaboration with the local community and the government.
That's what David, Sabrina, and the canine unit are working on. David says the unit has managed to reduce the number of poachers in the park centre, and the hounds have improved their ability to find poachers. Sabrina and her fellow hound, Dodie, have carried out several successful raids. The rangers are armed. They undergo a 7-month military-style training under the tutelage of former Belgian commandos. Training that is sorely needed, as the job presents serious risks. Since 1994, Virunga has lost over 140 rangers while protecting the park. Once the poachers are caught, they're handed over to the relevant authorities. But according to Saleh from the World Wildlife Fund, patrolling simply isn't enough.
For example, if we know there are some people have poaching, we're trying to find another alternatives for their income, the increasing their livelihood.
Roughly 4 million people live in and around the park. The majority of them survive off less than a dollar a day. For many locals, conservation has to come second to making a living. Most of the captured poachers are locals who come from the surrounding areas. The staff at Virunga know that if they want to combat poaching, they will have to create more opportunities for people. For the team at Virunga, they're betting on hydroelectricity. Virunga already has one hydroelectricity plant in Mutwanga, in the far north of the park. The plan is to use power to increase employment opportunities, says Emmanuel de Marode. He's the director of Virunga National Park.
And so that's why the hydroelectricity is so exciting, because with water from the park, from a national park that's healthy, you can convert that into electricity, and then downstream from that, you can use that electricity to power agro-industry, small-scale agro-industry, but many, many of these new businesses.
The Mutwanga hydro plant is expected to create 400 to 500 jobs, and the park plans to build another 6 hydro plants over the next 7 years.
Based on the experience we've had, the data that we've collected, we'll be able to create between 80 and 100,000 jobs in the region. And that really is giving real opportunities for a more dignified, more affluent future for young men and women, Congolese young men and women.
That's the plan, and it's an ambitious one. But it will take years for the rangers to see the impact of the program on the poaching industry. Back in the park, Sabrina has successfully located the hidden ranger, concealed in a nearby village.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, Sabrina.
Wow.
The exercise today was just that, an exercise. But it's not always so.
You know, if anything happens, you are all ready to fight.
For the fight to end poaching in Virunga, David, Sabrina and their team are the front line. Mae Francis, DW, Rumengabo, Democratic Republic of Congo.
As the demand for horn and ivory mounts, traffickers are becoming ever more inventive about how to get their products sold on the black market. Nowadays, they're selling online, explains Tanya McRae-Steele from the International Fund for Animal Welfare.
Well, we're seeing individuals, but sometimes organised criminal gangs who are going on the likes of online marketplaces, such as companies like eBay, and posting adverts of body parts or live animals for sale. And then they're shipping these items out to wherever the customers are. And that could be anywhere in the world. So this is big, transnational, and in some cases, very organised crime.
With the click of a mouse, people can buy exotic animals or parts of them online just as easily as they can buy books or shoes.
Some of the most disturbing have been severed monkey paws or taxidermied monkey heads. We're seeing stuffed animals. In addition, we're seeing pictures of live animals kept in appalling conditions. We've seen pictures of chimpanzees that are sat on a concrete floor and they're in tiny cages and they've got no enrichment. And you know that those animals are suffering and they're just sat there waiting to be purchased by somebody online.
Shoppers can even pre-order an animal that hasn't been caught or killed yet.
We're also getting reports from enforcers where these animals are being killed on demand to supply the online trade. We know of examples in the UK where monkeys are being killed in Indonesia, or being commissioned to be killed in Indonesia, shipped back to the UK and then sold to buyers all around the world.
Tanya, who leads the project on fighting global wildlife cybercrime, works with law enforcement and online tech companies eBay, Microsoft and Tencent to monitor and remove the ads online.
The main challenge for us is being able to identify the illegal products from the legal products, because there is a legal trade in wildlife, even endangered wildlife. And the challenge when you're looking online is identifying what the product is, because we're seeing people deliberately trying to disguise their items. And so you have to be an expert to be able to recognize a piece of ivory or a piece of rhino horn. We spend a lot of time working with enforcement experts that have the knowledge and the expertise to identify products just based on pictures, because they've got 10, 20 years experience of looking at the product in real life.
Increasingly, experts are looking to advance technology such as DNA testing and forensic analysis. This, CITES Secretary General John Scanlon says, can determine whether the source of ivory or horn is legal or not.
The use of modern forensics is a game changer in terms of combating illegal trade. We've seen Germany here make available to the international community its database on isotopes, and that is technology that allows you to determine the age and origin of ivory.
And some experts are already putting this technology to the test. At the University of Pretoria in South Africa, scientists have developed a groundbreaking technique to collect and catalogue DNA from rhinos and rhino horn. It's hoped that using this technology will lead to more convictions of poachers. Jan-Philipp Schluter paid a visit to the laboratory. Sarah Steffen presents his report.
Here we go.
Cindy Harper takes us on a tour in her lab. She's standing in front of a metal cabinet stuffed with plastic bags full of evidence and pulls out a couple of items.
Here we have a knife, which has potentially been used in a poaching incident. Okay, here we have an axe. There are a significant number of axes. Obviously, this is the most popular weapon to use by poachers to actually remove the horns. And this is a panga, which is another popular tool to use to take off the horns. These, and with axes, is we'd spray to look for blood. Then we will collect blood and do a DNA profile if it's from a rhino.
Harper is the head of the Veterinary Genetics Laboratory at the University of Pretoria. It's where they started the so-called RODIS project 5 years ago. RODIS, short for Rhino DNA Indexing System, is a database that aims to register all rhinos in South Africa and 5 other African countries.
Doing an individual identification or individual fingerprint from a rhinoceros horn, something that had never been done before. You can link that piece of horn to a crime scene. So it's very powerful forensic evidence.
So far, some 18,000 rhinos are registered in that database. In order to check each rhino's specific genetic fingerprint, Harper and her team of scientists have developed special forensic sample collection kits.
Okay, this is a this is one of our crime kits. It contains everything that you need for the sampling process, the tubes, a scalpel, gloves, the form that you need to fill in, the bottles you need to put all the samples in, and they're all labeled with barcode labels that all are connected to each other. They'll seal it up at the side of the animal. They'll take another photograph to show it was sealed at the side of the animal, which then takes care of the chain of custody.
At the crime scene, the scientists use an app to enter the data into the database. That's all that's needed to register the rhino. The DNA tests, however, are processed in the state-of-the-art lab in Pretoria. The rhino horn is an excellent DNA carrier. The scientists simply need a tiny sample of about 20 milligrams or 0.3 grains.
We've actually done a case where the horns had already been sold on. They'd been removed. There were only the bags left. And these bags, they shook them out, brought us just the dust that was left in the bags. And we utilized those small pieces of dust to do complete DNA profiles from. Those profiles were then linked back to animals that were poached in the Kruger National Park.
Harper and her team have already been successful in producing evidence that has led to the conviction and imprisonment of quite a number of poachers, smugglers and dealers. Even the very first case was a success, when a smuggler was caught at the international airport in Johannesburg with a bag full of rhino horns.
Two of those horns were linked back to carcasses of poached rhinos, and that person got 10 years sentence with obviously the assistance of this DNA evidence as well. That was to us almost the most important one because it set the precedent.
However, the daily work as a rhino forensic scientist can often be frustrating. Rhino horns are in high demand and illegal trade is booming. Poachers killed so many rhinos that the lab has more than 2,000 DNA samples, that they still need to look at.
I think people are not aware of the amount of work behind the scenes and the people putting in every effort, and that big steps forward are being made, but it does take time, unfortunately. Organized crime is really a formidable enemy, and there's a great deal of money behind that. So that makes it more difficult, and I think everybody is making significant steps. It's just not always very visible.
Sarah Steffen with that report by Jan Philip Schluter. DNA testing is just one of the many approaches the CITES conference, which runs until October 5th, is considering. While Africa's majestic giants like the rhino and the elephant are a hot topic on the agenda, the conference will also be looking at adding new and much smaller creatures to the list of protected species, says CITES Secretary General John Scanlon.
We've got the psychedelic rock gecko on the list of species to be listed here as well, and the earless monitor, and the tomato frog, as well as the false tomato frog. So they're all up for listing as well. So let's not forget the smaller animals as well, because they're an important part of the ecosystem too.
One of those is the Banggai cardinal fish. This Indonesian reef fish makes a striking addition to ornamental fish tanks. But sadly, its popularity could soon see it wiped out in its natural habitat. Globally, the trade in ornamental fish is a multi-million dollar industry. And popular movies like Finding Nemo can help fuel the demand for colourful home aquariums. Here in Germany, kids and no doubt some adults have been waiting in anticipation for Finding Dory, which features a forgetful tangfish. The movie, which was released in the US in June, will hit the big screen in Germany soon. But as Brigitte Osterhardt learned, conservationists and animal welfare activists have mixed feelings about the film. Connor Dillon presents this report.
In the US, Finding Dory, the sequel to the hit film Finding Nemo, has already become one of the most successful animated films ever. The friendly but forgetful surgeon fish searches for her parents, who've been caught by humans, but then gets trapped herself.
Hello? Oh, hi! Can you help me? I lost my family. Where are you? Ah! Ah! Help! Somebody help me!
Conservationists hope that Finding Dory will raise public interest in preserving our oceans and the species that live there. But they also saw an unfortunate side effect of Nemo the clownfish's huge popularity. Marius Tünte of the German Animal Welfare Association explains.
After the first movie, we recognized that the demand on this special fish, the clownfish, raised in Germany because kids see that fish and they want to have that. And a lot of parents thought that that animal is quite easy to handle, perhaps also quite cheap.
Sadly, that's far from true. Having a saltwater aquarium at home is expensive and time-consuming. The animals need constant care. Tünte says many seawater fish, like the clownfish, die in fish tanks because the owners can't look after them properly. And most marine fish have such complicated life cycles that it's impossible to breed them in captivity.
Almost 90% of the seawater fish in Germany are captured from the wild, from the sea. And that's really a problem because a lot of animals die during the fishing and during the transport. Yeah, it's a kind of animal welfare problem.
And it's not only the fish that are killed as a result, conservationists say. Other species that live on the reefs are also at risk, explains aquarium trade expert Gunther Hein.
Anyone who has scuba dived before knows that it's pretty hard to catch live fish underwater, even when they are schooling. So fishermen use narcotics. The fish drift to the surface, the fishermen collect them and put them into water containers.
This chemical agent is poisonous sodium cyanide. Very low doses render the fish temporarily unconscious. But even low doses of cyanide can kill other fish and organisms on the reef. cyanide fishing can devastate ecosystems. Conservationists estimate that for every aquarium fish that is sold, 1 square meter of coral reef is destroyed because of cyanide fishing. Globally, the saltwater aquarium trade is a multi-million dollar industry. Like Dory, millions of ocean creatures end up in fish tanks around the world.
Uh-oh, not good.
What? What is it? What happened? Oh, what's that?
That there is bad news. It's a transport tag for fish who can't cut it inside the institute. They get transferred to permanent digs, an aquarium.
Some species are in such demand that they're being caught faster than they can reproduce, meaning they could vanish from the wild altogether. But owning a home aquarium does not have to harm the environment. At a trade fair near Cologne, Germany, crowds of aquarium enthusiasts meet to buy and sell animals. The room is filled with small tanks containing fish in a dazzling array of shapes and colors, as well as other underwater creatures like shrimps and crabs. Everywhere, deals are being struck. One visitor is interested in a group of gray angelfish, species with round, flat bodies and elongated fins. The breeder makes his pitch.
The dark, slightly bigger ones here are smoke angelfish. They are the result of crossbreeding with a black angelfish. They're a bit more expensive, €5.50. I have 2, 4, 6, 8 of them.
But there are no marine fish here. Only freshwater species are sold, and only those bred in captivity. Joost Bocherding breeds 30 different species of catfish at his home. He points to a dynamic little character, about 3 centimeters long, with fetching black and white stripes.
Das ist ein sogenannter L168. Der deutsche Name ist Schmetterlingsharnischwels.
This is a so-called L168, a butterfly pleco, and the price is €12. I only sell rebred animals. I do import catfish from abroad from time to time for breeding purposes, but I have never imported a catfish to sell it.
A freshwater tank is definitely a better option than a saltwater one, say conservationists and animal welfare activists. Some 90% of freshwater fish are bred in captivity, but even those taken from the wild can be caught sustainably, explains aquarium trade expert Gunter Hein.
Beispielsweise Neonfische.
Take the neon tetra, for example. Millions of these freshwater fish survive in ditches beside South American rivers when low tide is coming. If people don't go and take them out, they will die soon anyway. Catching those fish is good income for the locals. You could breed neon tetra in captivity, yes, but this would mean taking the jobs away from those people.
Projects like this one might be worth seeking out, if you're inspired by the animated characters on screen, to bring a little piece of underwater life home. Conservationists say, go for freshwater fish, and leave Dory and her friends in the open ocean, right where they belong.
Connor Dillon with that report by Brigitte Olsterath. Well, that wraps up today's Wildlife Trade episode. Special thanks to our reporter Bobby Bascombe at the CITES conference in Johannesburg. Thanks to Ruby Russell and our studio team Eliana Giarducci and Yaron Kut. I'm Charlotte Lomas. Catch you next week.
I don't understand the game. Oh, who I'm meant to be. It's driving me insane the way you're playing.